Good evening. This is Bob E equals MC square Hope again on the fourth and final broadcast of our atomic series, The Quick and the Dead. Tonight we take up what is to me the most important date of the atomic age. Let me show you something. Here I have a pencil, an ordinary lead pencil. I take it and I write down that date. Now, if I were to take the lead that I used in writing that date, just that which came off on the paper, and put it on a scale, it would weigh less than 1/1000th of an ounce, less than one hair on your head. Yet, on that date, the United States of America took from its atomic pile at Oak Ridge a mass of radioactive material weighing no more than that pencil lead, and, as Bill Lawrence puts it, performed a feat far greater than Alamogordo or Hiroshima. The mission was airborne on August the 2nd, 1946.
I was present at the birth of the atomic age at Alamogordo. And since then, have witnessed every atomic explosion but a Russian one and one other. I saw a Japanese city crumble into dust. I watched a column of water weighing 15 million tons catapulted out of the Pacific Ocean. But to me, as a newspaper man, the August 2nd mission was the one that really made me realize the potential of the atomic age. As it was with the Hiroshima bomb, four engines lifted a giant plane into the sky. The exact size of the Hiroshima bomb is still a secret. So was the size of its container, but not so with this one. A crew member who lifted it aboard described it this way.
When I first saw the container, it looked like just another wooden box with an iron handle on it, about a foot square. But when I tried to lift it, I could hardly budge it. I learned later it weighed about 65 pounds and was lined with heavy lead.
If that crew member had lifted the lid, which was sealed, he would have found a lead box within the wooden box, and within that, a steel protective surface. To open this cylinder requires a special wrench, not unlike the one with which you change a spare tire. Deep in this cylinder is a tiny well. In the well, a tiny bottle. If you were to lift up that tiny bottle, you would notice a minuscule potion of a reddish-brown liquid. It is neither uranium nor plutonium. It is radioactive iodine.
My name is Johnny McGrath. I am 14 years old. In 1946, I was taken to a hospital for the third time. This time they told my folks I had thyroid cancer. They said they were going to try to cure me with radioactive iodine.
August the 2nd, 1946, the date on which Oak Ridge sent its first shipments of radioactive materials into combat to help man in a ceaseless battle against disease and suffering.
The Quick and the Dead, a document for ear on atomic energy, produced and transcribed by the NBC News and Special Events Department. Tonight we take up some of the peacetime uses of atomic energy, and much of the program originates at the Memorial Center for Cancer Research and Allied Diseases in New York, the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and many other great research centers throughout America. In every instance, the voices are those of the actual doctors and scientists involved, and the case of Johnny McGrath was taken directly from the files of the Memorial Hospital. Now back to Mr. Hope, as he and the rest of our taxpayers pay our final visit to our atomic tutor, Mr. William Lawrence of the New York Times.
Bill, I don't mind telling you, I've had a lot of mail telling us what a swell thing we're doing with this series. But a few people have written in and said, it's all fine, Bob, but can't some good come out of this? From all these great minds and all this supreme production and $2 billion, can't something other than bombs be born?
People often ask me that, too.
What's the answer?
Don't you know?
I hope I do. I even wrote some of these people and said that just because we use electric current in electric chairs, that doesn't mean that electricity is good for that purpose only.
Good analogy, Bob.
Was I right?
Of course you were right.
Well, the morning papers don't look that way these days.
Right now, the atomic age is like a child with scarlet fever. The child has enormous talent and a brilliant future ahead of him.
If he can once get over the scarlet fever.
That's the way it is with these first years of the atomic age. If we can learn to live in the atomic age without allowing this great energy to blow up the world, there is almost nothing the atom can't do for us.
Go on.
Bob, civilization has arrived at the gates of a great cosmic treasure house. And Einstein and Fermi and Lisa Meitner and others have handed us the key to unlock these mighty riches.
All right, Bill, you're going to make me say it again. Never mind the poetry. What does that mean?
Bob, when the Lord created the universe, he put 99% of all the material energy in it in a vast treasure house for safekeeping. But until Hiroshima, only the sun and the stars had a drawing account, and this bank of the universe, which comprises the capital resources of creation.
Never mind the platitudes, Bill. Can I get energy at this bank of yours to run my car?
No.
Can I heat my house? Can I run a factory? Can I...
No, you can't, Bob.
Then let's close out the account.
Not so fast, Bob.
Let's get down to cases. Exactly what and where is atomic energy doing anything other than making destructive bombs?
If you happen to be the father of 14-year-old John McGrath, the lad with the thyroid cancer, you would thank atomic energy for the fact that he's still alive.
They all thought I had TB because I coughed all the time, sometimes blood. In 1947, they took me to Memorial Center Hospital in New York. They said I had a cancer.
You asked for a specific example of atomic energy in everyday action. There are many cases. But let's start out by taking the case of Johnny McGrath. The atom fire at Oak Ridge is the only hope to save his life.
Seriously or figuratively?
Seriously, literally.
Now, wait a minute. Let's make sure that Hope knows exactly what a cancer is. I know that it's a vicious killer, and that many of my closest friends have died of it. I know that it ends up as a poisonous growth, but what is it to start with?
Most people don't know what a cancer really is. So, before we go to Oak Ridge, let's go to the Memorial Center Hospital in New York, where Johnny McGrath is to be treated. Dr. C.P. Rhodes, one of the top cancer men in the country, is the director of the Sloan Kettering Institute and of the hospital. Listen to his vivid definition of the word cancer.
Now, a cancer is a gangster in the human body. Just exactly as Hitler's Germany was a gangster and a bully in the family of nations. In the human body, there are billions of cells. Normally, these cells are all well-disciplined. They perform definite, healthy functions within your body as a team. But occasionally, gangster cells are born. These gangsters are normal cells gone berserk. They eat more than their share. They rob and steal. They grow strong. They multiply. And like Hitler's legion, they spread and infiltrate to the other tissues, constantly devouring the rightful inhabitants of the human body. Eventually, there is no resistance left, and the body collapses and dies.
They are fighting this gangster cell with every weapon they can lay their hands on. Oak Ridge has given us not only a new weapon, but also a radar system to help detect the presence of cancers.
The doctor says they're going to give me a radioactive cocktail.
But first, let's go to the arsenal, where the weapons are forged.
I work at Oak Ridge. Early in 1946, our routine changed just slightly. Every few days, instead of putting uranium sticks into every hole of the pile, into just a few holes, we put other elements. We left this new element in the pile just long enough for it to become radioactive. When we took it out, it was radioactive iodine. Special equipment was used to insert this element into the pile so that no hands ever touched it or even saw it except by mirrors. We put it into lead-lined boxes, all by remote control. The first shipments went by air and were addressed to, among others, Massachusetts General Hospital, Washington University, the Mayo Clinic, Montefiore Hospital, and Memorial Center Hospital, New York.
My name is Robert Howard. I'm the receiving clerk at the Memorial Center Hospital in New York. In August of 1946, they called us out from LaGuardia Airport and told us to come out and pick up a package from somewhere in Tennessee. When I got out there, we saw a very small box with heavy handles and a label. When I started to pick it up, I almost fell over. I could hardly lift it. When I looked closer, I saw the words, caution, and the skull and bones warning. And then a label from Oak Ridge. This is a shipment of isotopes. Radioactive.
Now, wait a minute, Bill. I'm confused again. What's an isotope?
That box from Oak Ridge contained isotopes of iodine.
but you said they were radioactive.
That's what made them isotopes. So that when we remove the iodine from the pile, it has an added neutron. It is now what we call a radioactive isotope of iodine.
Okay, Professor. Where do we go from here? What has this all got to do with Johnny McGrath's lung cancer?
Johnny has a cancer, but a special kind of cancer. That's why it is radioactive iodine that has been shipped. Listen to Johnny's doctor, Ruland W. Rosen, describe the exact kind of cancer that young Johnny has.
As Rhodes said earlier, cancers are gangsters, but there are many kinds of gangsters, each with their own characteristics and each with their own appetite. Remember that word, appetite. That's a key word. Johnny's symptoms were excessive coughing and abnormal shadows in the chest x-ray. It was not tuberculosis. We diagnosed it as a thyroid cancer that had migrated and taken root in another part of the body. The question was where, and even we could find that out, what could we do about it?
Poor kid. Well, Bill, couldn't they kill that cancer with x-ray or radium?
There are two things you can do to a cancer once you find it. You can cut it out, or you can burn it out with x-ray or radium.
In Johnny's case, we couldn't operate, and although a million volts of x-ray might have killed the cancer, the powerful rays of the x-ray would have destroyed all of Johnny's skin tissue and organs near the cancer, and probably would have killed Johnny. So that was out. Dr. Rawl and I decided to study the effects of radioactive iodine on this child's cancer of the thyroid.
My name is Hilda Yee. I am a technician in the physics department at Memorial. Dr. Rawson's office called and said they wanted to give a tracer dose of 500 microcuries to John McGrath. I opened the Oak Ridge container and then, with rubber-covered tongs, poured the contents into a glass flask and added distilled water. Then I tested it with a Geiger counter to make sure the radioactivity was as prescribed.
Bill, is that just like the neutron counter they had at Stagg Field in Oak Ridge?
This is a Geiger counter, the little brother of a neutron counter. It does practically the same thing.
Then I picked up the glass flask containing the iodine. Actually, it was 99.999% pure water. Then I put the flask in a lead-carrying case and brought it to Johnny's room.
Hello, Johnny. How do you feel today?
Pretty good, Doc.
Johnny, here's that radioactive drink I was telling you about. Hilda here will pour it into that paper cup for you.
Looks like plain water to me.
That's just what it'll taste like, Johnny.
I lifted the flask out of the lead container, still using the tongs, and with another pair of tongs, held a paper cup into which I poured Johnny's tracer dose of isotope. Johnny took it in his hand, took a quick sip, decided it wasn't medicine, and swallowed it in one gulp.
That's all there is to it, Johnny. See you tomorrow.
Now, wait a minute, Bill. What's the idea? From the time that radioactive iodine leaves Oak Ridge, no human hands touch it. Even the technician Hilda holds it with tongs. How come they let Johnny lift the cup up with his own hands and drink it?
Everybody asks that, Bob. That much radioactive iodine, or five times that much, wouldn't hurt anyone. But the technicians are working with it every day now. And the cumulative effect might be bad for them.
The amount of radioactivity Johnny has swallowed is minute, but for absolute safety's sake, we'll keep him isolated from other patients for 24 hours, and his urine will be especially observed and kept for a few weeks in a lead container before being thrown away.
So what happens next? Does that drink cure Johnny?
No, indeed. But what they have done so far is to send a million little x-ray machines into Johnny McGrath's veins.
I'm lost again. What do they do?
As Dr. Rosen said earlier, there were two things we had to do. First, find Johnny's cancer, and then try to treat it. But first, let me ask you, Bob, how did the United States learn that Russia had an atom bomb?
Well, you told us last week. A Geiger counter picked up a radioactive cloud drifting out from behind the Iron Curtain.
That's right. Geiger counters always respond to radioactivity like burglar alarms to a midnight prowler. Remember that now as we get back to Johnny.
48 hours later, I went back to Johnny's room, put him in a wheelchair, and pushed him down to our physics laboratory where we keep a very sensitive Geiger counter. I asked Johnny to lie down on a table. I turned on the Geiger counter. Then the doctor started to give me instructions.
All right. Check his upper skull.
No response. Cranium negative.
Hey, how come, Bill? I thought he was radioactive.
But only a certain part of him. Those thyroid cells are different from all other cells, even unlike other cancer cells. But oddly and wonderfully, thyroid cancer cells have a tremendous appetite for iodine. After Johnny drank his cocktail, most of the iodine had concentrated within the thyroid cancer. But where?
Try the left jaw, Hilda.